You can be seated. And kids, kindergarten through second grade, if you're headed to story time, you can make your way out to story time. Kids, third and up, make sure you grab one of the bulletins so you're filling it out and bringing it to me afterwards for your prizes. And our theme this morning as we go through the book of Hebrews is going to be in Hebrews chapter 4. And we're going to meditate on the call to draw near. So since we have this great high priest, we're going to draw near to the throne of grace that we may receive mercy and find grace in our time of need. So that's going to be our theme. And, you know, there's needs that you're aware of, that you know you need them. And then there's needs that you're not aware of until you do need them and it becomes obvious. And even this week, I mean, who would have thought on Sunday, we had no idea what could be coming our way. And then by Wednesday, you think, all right, you're going to lay down and go to sleep, and who knows what you're going to wake up on Thursday morning and see. And so we have this promise for grace in our time of need. A couple other just announcements. One of the, if you came in, as you're all aware, we're in an election season. And one of the things that we need is just kind of help thinking through and navigating the different issues that we have to think about. At our last Guys Night Out, one of our themes this year is kind of public engagement. What's it look like for faithful Christian engagement in the public sphere? And kind of tongue-in-cheek, I asked ChatGPT, I said, give us a list of the most important policy considerations one would need to think about in order to form an informed opinion about who to vote for. And I was expecting three or four. It spit out 12 of them, and then we read them at Guys Night Out, and part of the kind of the humor is that, well, actually all of these are important, and nobody in this room even, you know, knows things about all of these, so it's going to take work. So one of the things kind of we need to do in to be informed in citizens is to inform yourself of what's going on. And a great resource, if you haven't met Jim Venetti, Jim worked for 30 years in D.C., and he'd be a wonderful resource if you want someone to help you think about these things. And one of the organizations that he's partial to is this Florida Family Voice, and so they're looking at helping think policy procedures from the lens of what's going to promote the good of the family, as the family is kind of the core building block of society. So here's a little tool and resource to help you think through those things. Jim will be passing that. We'll try and have other things throughout the month just to help you think about these things, because we need help in our time of need. But what I want to do this morning is really be a little unique. So in one sense, you know, just to parse and get technical, technically I wouldn't call this a normal sermon, because sermon would have certain kind of conventions and structure. This is more of a meditation on Hebrews 14 and 15. And just thinking throughout the week is, you know, who knows what we're going to have to deal with. And we've come to the point, thought it was really, you know, divinely, you know, ironic, coincidental. We've come to the point in chapter 4 where we're in chapter 4, verse 14, where it says, since then we have a great high priest who's passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God. Let us hold fast to our confession. We do not have a high priest who's unable to sympathize with our weakness, but one who is in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. So I just want to take that invitation to us to draw near. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace. So we're just going to kind of meditate on that this morning. My goal this morning is that when you leave here, I hope your heart is encouraged to draw near confidence. confidently draw near to the throne of grace. Now, this passage is important to note. It is a kind of a transition in the book. So the book is one, in essence, large sermon for encouragement and exhortation. And we've come, there's a kind of a threefold movement in the sermon. And the first part is celebrating Jesus as our great apostle who's come and he's delivered the authoritative, final, glorious word of the living God to his people. And this word is living and it's active and it's powerful. And today when you hear his voice, don't harden your hearts because it's going to speak to you. And then now we're transitioning to the beauty, the power, the privilege, the glory that Jesus is also our great high priest. And he's passed into the heavenlies and he's made a way open so we now can come into the presence of the living Lord. So from chapter 5 all the way to chapter 10, verse 18, it's all about the glory of Jesus's high priestly ministry. So if you kind of look, all right, Jesus is greater than the prophets. He's greater than Moses. He showed us. And then now he's going to say he's greater than Aaron. He's of a greater priesthood. And the whole thing is framed around this call. Let us hold fast. Let us draw near. And let us keep going. Don't give up. And those are going to be things that he just reiterates all through. It's like a symphony. He'll hit those notes over and over. And you can even see in chapter 4, 14 through 16, and then in chapter 10, 19 through 25, they're almost identical, just deframing those two things. Hold fast, draw near, keep going, strive, press on towards maturity. So the central theme of this section is because of Jesus' unique role as the high priest. He can understand our weakness, and now we can approach him, approach God the Father with confidence through his grace and mercy. So let's just think about a couple questions. What does it mean to draw near? How do we draw near? There's a command, draw near to the throne. And this is probably going to be hard. Like, this is probably harder on Americans than any other historic people. Because, I mean, we don't do kings. We don't do kind of authority, hierarchy. We don't really, that's not really our thing. So we don't really understand, draw near to a throne. And then even, it's going to be even harder on us as Floridians. Because, I mean, America, we already are pretty informal people. And then we are like as informal as it gets. You know, sometimes I have like, you know, it's one of the curses of studying church history because I have like people's voices in the back of my mind. And like the person I did my doctoral dissertation on, Martin Lloyd-Jones, was probably the preeminent British pastor in the 1950s. And he also had a home office like I do. And he would never leave his bedroom if he was not in full suit and tie. Just of the dignity of the office required. There's kind of a pretty funny picture of him laying on the beach in full suit and tie reading a book by Emil Brunner called The Divine Imperative. So, I mean, that guy knew how to have fun. And so he probably would be a little bit ashamed of my attire at the moment, that these dress shoes, I mean, these are even half dress shoes, half tennis shoes. That is an abomination. These two things do not combine. So, I mean, we are a very informal people. We need to say, for the rest of the history of the world, when you have a summons to come into the presence of the king, like, how do you come? And, of course, one of the things, you draw near with reverence. You draw near with to pay homage, to honor. And this is both East and West. You know, there's interesting stories that go back to the Roman Empire, where if Caesar was planning a trip to a certain village, the villager, they would spend an entire year preparing. It's also true in Japan. If it was ever the emperor would travel around and those villages would prepare for the coming for a whole year. But we come with reverence, come ready to bow down. Come ready to serve. We draw near with reverence. But there's also an issue. You draw near kind of with holiness. I mean, part of the beauty of this passage is that his blood will wash you clean so you can come in clean. You can't come in dirty, but part of the point of the gospel is, well, you can't clean yourself. It's part of the imagery of baptism. Someone from the outside has to wash you because you can't wash yourself, but you have to be washed. You don't come in dirty. You have to draw near with reverence, draw near with holiness, but you also draw near with joy. You know, the remarkable things about the heavenly throne is since you have access to the heavenly throne, it can transform any location. into a place of celebration. It's one of the things Jesus tells his disciples on the night that he's leaving. He says, it is good that I go away, because then my joy can come and you can experience it to the full. So the power of this throne of grace is it can transform, like for Paul, a prison cell can become an entry point into the throne room. So there's always access to his presence, and that means there's always the possibility of joy. But then we ought to draw near. We have to draw near with submission. You know, this is part of the delicate balance, because this is a beautiful word we looked at a couple weeks ago. Let us draw near with boldness, some translations, with confidence, some translations. If you remember a couple weeks ago, the word literally is a political term for free speech. We draw near with the freedom of speech. It means, you know, in a very, some of you maybe come from different cultures where there's a very hierarchical way that you speak to people who are above you and below you, and just certain kind of conventions. And for outsiders, they can look and like, I don't know what's going on. You're not supposed to say this. You're not supposed to look this way. But this is the idea that you now have access where you can speak freely. You've been granted freedom of speech in his presence. But you come, so we balance that freedom and that boldness with also reverence and humility. So we come submitting. We don't come arrogantly. We don't come entitled. Don't come demanding or trying to domineer or manipulate. You know, we come into the presence of the King submissively, even learning from his majestic Son, who is willing to pray, "Thy will be done." So we come with that posture, but then we also come expectantly, that we come believing that he can do something. There's a great line from one of John, "With thee, large petitions bring." So you come expecting him to be a king. There's a humorous story of Alexander the Great when he was rewarding his generals for battlefield victories. He would bring them in and ask, "What would you like me to give you?" And one of the generals made this request. It was just completely outlandish, that the other generals were offended that he would even make such a request, and they wanted to kill him on the spot for his insolence for asking for such a thing. And Alexander the Great kind of laughed and said, "He's proving by the magnitude of his request what he thinks about the magnitude of my resources. So he's not offending me, he's honoring me with such a request. Large, thou art coming to a king. Large petitions with thee bring." But we also draw near. We want to draw near in confidence. You know, you think, all right, what would give me the courage to draw near? It's because he's commanded us. He said, "Come, draw near." So that's how we draw near. But now the next question is, where do we draw near? Where do we go? And you know, it's a throne. I mean, it's his throne. We're coming to the seat of authority and power and rule. It's a throne. We're not going to the back door, like looking for table scraps. You know, we're not like Tramp from The Lady and the Tramp, who goes to the back door of the restaurant, scratching on the door, hoping for today's leftovers. You know, we go to the throne. We have access anytime, and what a privilege. What an honor. Elevated, imminent. But we come to the throne, but notice, what type of throne is it? It's a throne of grace. You know, he's already told us this throne of majesty. He's seated at the right hand of his majesty on high. And one of the themes is that everyone will come and stand before the throne of judgment. But through Christ, we now come, and it's a throne of grace. One of the things that's been really interesting to juxtapose, because we spent all last year going through the book of Exodus, and then now in Hebrews, because Hebrews is so rich with taking these themes from Exodus of the priesthood and these different things of coming near to this heavenly Sinai. But you remember, one of the themes in Exodus is Moses has to say, basically, don't come too close. Like, here's the line, and if you come too close, then you, animal, everybody's going to die. And then here in Hebrews, it's almost like the curtain has been laid down, the barrier removed, and now he says, come, draw near. It's a throne of grace. And I love what Charles Spurgeon says about this. He says, what that means is, at a throne of grace, the weakness of my prayers are going to be overlooked. So that I don't have to stand on ceremony to get the words just right. He'll know the thoughts and the intentions of my heart. So even if my words are lame and limping and blind and stumbling, it's a throne of grace, and he looks over that. And he says, but also the weakness, not of the prayers, but of the prayer, is also overlooked. He says, sometimes we come with such mixed motives where we think we can barter. Okay, God, you do this, and I'll give this. You do this, and I'll give this. Or like it's a place of taxation. I remember when I was in high school, I used to just earnestly pray that, God, if you would just give me a car, my promise to you is I'll only listen to Christian music in it ever. And I prayed that over and over. Finally, he did, in his mercy and, you know, parent sacrifice, I got my car. And it always be so like conflicted in my conscience when I'd start to kind of scan the dial away from our version of the Z. It's like, man, I promise God, only Christian music. So we don't come that way to barter. So I love that. I was really surprised reading Charles Spurgeon on this passage, because he's British pastor, 1800s, probably the greatest preacher ever to speak English. You could make a case for other preachers, but probably the greatest. What he accomplished in ministry is just, it's almost unbelievable when you look at the statistics. But on this passage, here's a long quote that he says, I usually feel more dissatisfied with my prayers than with anything else I do. So he's probably one of the greatest. His nickname is the Prince of Preachers, and then he'd get home from service on Sunday afternoon and often feel so discouraged, because you think about, oh man, that sermon just wasn't good. And this is a sermon that people are going to print and then sell thousands of copies. But then the thing that he would feel guilty about is when I was praying in public. I couldn't bring the people to the throne of grace. He said, I feel more dissatisfied with my prayers than anything else I do. I do not believe that it's an easy thing to pray in public so as to conduct the devotions of a large congregation aright. It says, we sometimes hear people who are commended for their preaching well, but if any should be enabled to pray well, that is an unequaled gift and of higher grace than any. But, brethren, suppose in our prayers there should be a defect of knowledge, it's a throne of grace, and the Father knows what we need. But suppose there should be in our prayers a defect of faith, he sees our little faith, and still he doth not reject it, small as it may be. He doth not in every case measure out his gifts by the degree of our faith, but by the sincerity and trueness of our faith. And if there should be a grave defect, even in our spirit, and the failure in the fervency or the humility in our prayer, these should not be there as much as they are desired. Grace will overlook it all. Forgiveness, all of this, and still in his merciful hands is stretched out to enrich us according to our need. Surely this ought to induce many to pray who have not prayed. It should make us who have been long accustomed to use the consecrated act of prayer to draw near with great boldness to his throne of grace. And he goes on to say, what do we come to when we come to the throne of grace? We're coming to a throne of victory. He says, we don't just come to grace as a thing. We come to grace as a person, and at the throne, someone is sitting on it. He says, grace came down to earth in the form of the well-beloved, and there he met with sin. Long and sharp was the struggle, and grace appeared to be trampled under the foot of sin. But grace at last seized sin and threw it on its own shoulders, and through all he crushed it beneath the burden. Grace carried sin up to the cross, nailed it there, slew it there, put it to death there forever, and triumphed gloriously over it there. For this cause, at this hour, grace sits on a throne, and because it has conquered every human sin, it has borne the penalty of every human guilt, and it has overthrown all his enemies. We come boldly. So we come to a throne of grace. But then now notice this. When do we draw near to that throne of grace? We draw near in our time of need. And what I found so fascinating looking at this word for time, you know, there's different Greek words for time. This is a Greek word for seasons. So you can translate it, we come in our season of need. So you know there's so many different seasons. You know, life in many ways is not like Florida, because here we have one season, maybe two. We have hot and hotter. We have hot and stay inside. And so, but life, there's so many different seasons. So, I mean, there's seasons of suffering, seasons of calm, seasons of summer heat, seasons of winter cold. There's seasons where the weather from the outside is affecting you. There's seasons where the turmoil is internal. It's intriguing looking at this passage. So John Owen, a great Puritan theologian, who probably wrote this masterpiece on the book of Hebrews. His commentary is 7 volumes on Hebrews. It's over 2 million words. And on this verse, he identifies there's 7 spiritual unique seasons that you can go to through. So as I read these, just think, have you ever experienced one of these seasons? They're unique spiritual seasons. So the first one is a seasons of affliction, where we're being afflicted and we have to learn that God is our help. Where do our eyes look? To whom shall we look? It says there's seasons of persecution, where persecution is coming from the outside. Seasons of temptation. So, you know, Paul had a unique season where 3 different times a messenger of Satan came after him. And Jesus in the wilderness, Satan came after him. And Jesus even tells Peter, Satan has asked to sift you. He's coming after you right now. That's an interesting word to that. Sift is really the same word for eclipse. So you kind of have the light shining, and Satan for a moment is going to eclipse the light so you enter into spiritual darkness. And that's a season. He said there's seasons of spiritual desertion, where what we feel is we feel like God has abandoned us and he is hiding his face. He said there's seasons of significant duty where the Lord comes to you. And, you know, for this season, like, says, you know, an example of this would be Abraham when God called him. All right now you're going to up and leave your country and go to where I will show you. So seasons of just unique energy and effort. Or Joshua when it was the season to enter into the promised land where some great action is required at this time. As we go through number 6, seasons of change, seasons of difficulty. He lived through one of the most tumultuous seasons of civil war in British English history. And he says, finally, the last spiritual season is the season of death, where we walk through. So spiritual seasons. What season are you in right now? Everyone is in a certain season. What season are you in? To compare that with just, you know, going through life. I was also intrigued because there's another interesting book by a guy named Bob Beale. And he did a extensive counseling survey. So he did over 50,000 interviews. And in his book, Decade by Decade, he says that every single decade you go through has its unique kind of challenges. So there's seasons. So I'll read what he says about the different decades and we'll see if it resonates with your experience. So children 10 and under, it's the season of seeking love and safety. Teens begin questioning the meaning of life, their role in it. 20s is your young adults forced to survive and figuring out how to navigate the adult world. 30s is your drive for success. 40s is reflections on the significance of your life. 50s, you begin to question life, arise about aging and whether you're really over the hill. 60s, focuses on finishing well, leaving your legacy. 70s, concerned with who will carry on the work. 80s, health become your predominant concern. And 90s, you prepare to end. So think about those. So for children, he says 10 and under, says the key question for that whole season is the question of, am I loved and am I safe? So in that season, what type of help can you come to the throne of grace? There is no better place to find the answer to the question, am I loved and am I safe? And teens, what do you go through there? He says, during that, you're asking, does any of this have to do with me? You're questioning the world around them, trying to understand your identity and role in society. And one of the most beautiful things about the potency and power of the gospel is the way it can answer these questions for teens or anyone else who's wrestling with these things. And one of the beautiful things about the gospel, when you're trying to figure out life, how do you make sense of this just mess that's the world and the mess that's me? Even though when you're a teenager, you don't realize you're a mess too, but you, at least you're starting to know the world's a mess. And the powerful thing about the gospel is I don't think there's anything else that can offer the triad of intellectual coherence. Like, the beautiful thing about the Bible is it can offer an explanatory framework that explains more of life than anything else. Nothing, I think, offers this type of intellectual coherence, but then also existential satisfaction that can meet you in the moments of need where you need it internally and emotionally. And you can hear stories of generations of generations of generations of people who have found solace in life and comfort and hope and peace and joy here. And then also, there is nothing that has been as transformative to the world as this gospel. So the gospel is the most potent force in the world to bring intellectual coherence, existential satisfaction, and world transformation. And as a teenager, you want to know, right, what can I give my life to that's worth it? And there is nothing more worthy than this person who we sing and celebrate, who's sitting on the throne named Jesus Christ. It can bring identity, formation, stability. In your 20s, can I survive in the adult world just trying to learn to navigate? In your 30s, what does success look like? There's nothing that can purge false views of success like a real biblical gospel. In the 40s, is my life meaningful? Do I have any significance? 50s, am I over the hill? Life and aging, what does it speak to? I mean, one of the things that's already been sung and celebrated in Hebrews is that he is the one who is the death conqueror. So if you're really beginning to wrestle with the reality of your own mortality, it is good to know the one who defeated the enemy. And then in the 60s, how do I finish well? How do I carry on what has been going? So what season of life are you in? Is this a season of wrestling with identity? A season of just trying to survive? A season of looking back? A season of regret and recalibration? Or a season of slowing down? Whatever season you're in, there is help for that season. And one of the beautiful things about this kind of help is it's appropriate to the season. You know, there's just certain help that's just not very helpful if it's not appropriate to the need. You know, think about seasonal needs. I feel like I'm picking on Florida a lot this morning, but here's my next analogy. I was about to make fun of us Floridians because once the temperature drops below about 50, everybody starts breaking out their winter coats. I mean, you'll see the full parkas and the hoodies and the gloves and the whole deal. And I don't know how helpful that is. Maybe you get really cold, but do you need help that's appropriate? You know, when you're going to Alaska, those things are very helpful. So the help is appropriate to the season. What season are you in? There's mercy to forgive you for your past and grace to empower the future. Then last, why can we draw near? Again, we come, I love this, we come to a person. We come to a throne, but the power is not in the chair. The power is who's seated in the chair. And it's a throne of grace. And one of the things I think as Protestants, because we're so committed to salvation is by grace alone, through faith alone, it is a gift. It is not something you earn. It is freely dispensed and given to us by the grace of Jesus Christ. So we love that idea. But sometimes I think we can confuse the freeness of the thing for the thing itself. So, for example, like if you ask one of the kids, like, what did you get for Christmas? And they say, oh, it was amazing. I, like, showed up, and I didn't pay a thing for the presents. I said, awesome. Well, what did you get? Oh, it was completely free. okay, but what actually was it? And so when we think about grace, we can think of kind of, oh, this is a free gift that comes. But what we actually get is we get Him. We get the Son. We get access to the Father. What we get in grace is not just that it's free. It's free access to His presence. What we get is we get Jesus. And what did He do to give us the gift of Himself and His Holy Spirit and His Word and His people? As He lived as our representative. He's our great high priest. And part of the high priestly role, He had two great roles. It was to represent the people to God, to be their representative in God's presence, and then represent God to the people. So His whole life was one of a substitute. He lived in our place. So He lived the perfect life as our substitute in our place. And this is going to highlight that He faced all the same temptations that we face, yet was without sin. And then He hung on the cross as our substitute, carrying that heavy load of sin. He died willingly, taking on Himself the punishment that we deserved. And as He experienced our rejection, He cried out in emotional agony. And it seems unthinkable to us. In chapter 5, we're going to get that he had to learn obedience through His suffering and His agony. And it seems unthinkable to us that somehow the Father separated Himself for the Son. How could the Trinity kind of be separated? It can blow your mind when you think about it, but somehow in Jesus' humanity, He cries out to God, my God, why have You forsaken Me? And He came to the earth knowing His job description, knowing that being the true high priest, this is what this would require, not just offer the sacrifice, but to be the sacrifice. And He knew that there would be a time when the Father would not exercise His power to come to His rescue. And as a man, Jesus would hang between heaven and earth, utterly forsaken, utterly alone, utterly rejected. And He endured all of those things so we wouldn't have to. Here's an amazing parallel in Matthew's gospel where He says, my God, why have You forsaken Me? And then to the disciples, He says, I am with you till the end of the age. I will never forsake you. I will never leave you. He was willing on the cross to be utterly alone so that we never would be. And that's the power of grace, is because it's manifest and found in the person of grace. And so now we have access. And another just beautiful, mind-blowing thing about that access is now He is the high priest who doesn't just open us a way so we can come to the Father. He's actively making intercession on our behalf. You just pause and think about that for a moment. Do you know that right now Jesus is actively praying for you? I mean, it was so encouraging to our soul when you have people, you know, like Rob and Dave, such godly men who are praying for us. At one of the prayer meetings that we have first Sunday night of every month, I came home so emotionally moved. And because you have people like Janet Vanetti who was praying for our children. And I thought, man, if anything good comes from our parenting, it is not because we're good parents. It's because we got people like that praying for us. And then you think, all right, do you know who's praying for you? You have the Son of the living God who's actively interceding on your behalf. And what a privilege. But then also it's worth thinking about, I wonder what He's praying. I wonder what He's praying for me about. I think about my family, my children. Often I'll ask, all right, Jesus, I need You to do this. Can You do this for them? And often that means do this so it makes my life easier. I wonder if that's what He's really praying for them about. And so we can enter in to His prayers as He's actively praying. What's Jesus praying for you, for your spouse, for your friends, for your community? Jesus is actively praying something for this community. I wonder what it is. Wonder how we can come get in tune with His praying for us. So we have this incredible privilege to draw near. We come. Why are we able to come? Because by His sacrifice, He opened up a way that we can come into His presence. And that's what we celebrate every Sunday when we celebrate the Lord's Supper. We come that His body was broken so we could be made whole. We celebrate that he shed his blood so that we could receive the forgiveness of sins. And with the forgiveness, now we have access to come into his presence. So in just a moment, I'm going to pray, and then we'll have our communion servers will go to their places. We have four stations here. The one in the back corner is gluten-free. And at Trinity, we come, and you take the wafer, and you dip. And this Sunday, we want to come celebrating the access that he's given us into his presence. So Lord, we thank you for the command to draw near. We thank you for the gift of your Son who makes that way possible. And so now I ask that you help us to come humbly, help us to come joyfully, but also help us to come confidently, knowing that we are coming to a King, and large petitions we can bring. And so Lord, I pray for everyone here. Everyone here is in a certain season where they need help for that season. It might be help physically, might be help relationally, might be help spiritually. It might be, there's just a whole range of help that's needed. So we thank you that we can ask for the help that we need in this season. And I thank you that at your throne of grace is an ocean of mercy and grace. So you will not have to dispense your grace with a little eardropper of just a little ounce here or a little ounce there. There is an ocean of mercy and grace. So help us. Thank you for the command to come. And now we do. We come into your presence asking for your help in our time of need. This we ask in Christ's holy name. Amen.